Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center, who analyzes the wider significance of Bolivia's popular rebellion, which forced U.S. ally President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada out of office. Former CIA Estimates Officer David McMichael, who takes a critical look at the Justice Department investigation into who in the Bush administration may have leaked the identity of a CIA covert operative. And Yael Martin, a member of the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace, who talks about a new coalition of women's groups which has come together to advance nonviolent solutions in the Middle East. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year ago, 17-year-old Daniel Joseph was aboard a crowded ship of 200 Haitians that landed on the Florida coast and was detained by immigration officials. Instead of being reunited with his uncle, a legal resident of Brooklyn, Joseph still sits in Miami's Boys Town Detention Center. According to Amnesty International, two immigration courts agreed to release Joseph's older brother David to his uncle on bond. But Attorney General John Ashcroft intervened on behalf of the Department of Homeland Security, saying the refugee threatened national security. Ashcroft ruled that releasing people pending asylum hearings would only encourage more immigration surges that would force the Coast Guard and the U.S. military to divert resources away from counterterrorism operations. Candace Jean, the attorney for the Joseph brothers, accused the Attorney General of using terrorism as an excuse to justify a racist immigration policy. In his controversial ruling, Ashcroft rejected the decisions of two immigration courts which said that each asylum seeker has a right to an individual hearing. But Ashcroft maintains that undocumented foreigners do not have such a right, and he unilaterally declared that the Attorney General is the final authority on all immigration law. Ruslan Sharipov, a human rights defender and journalist in Uzbekistan, has been threatened, tortured, and jailed for homosexual conduct. On September 26th, the Uzbek court upheld Sharipov's conviction, drawing the attention of Human Rights Watch, which noted that the persecution against him continues and he remains at risk of torture and ill treatment. Sharipov has written widely about government corruption. The journalist charges that in September, police officers placed a gas mask over his head, sprayed an unknown substance into his throat, and injected an unknown liquid into his veins. Officers then threatened to inject him with the HIV/AIDS virus and forced him to write his own suicide note. On October 28th, a month after his conviction, masked men kidnapped and severely beat Sharipov's public defender, Surat Ikrimov. Though the Ministry of Internal Affairs has promised an investigation, they have issued no findings to date. Human Rights Watch is asking the international community to call on the Uzbek government to release Sharipov immediately and to repeal the archaic criminalization of homosexual conduct. From a sleepy country road, the barn looks like any other in Stickeyville, Virginia, in the heart of Appalachia. There are rows of tobacco leaves drawing on wooden poles, and cured tobacco is coloring the countryside. According to E, the environmental magazine, the barn is the site of an organic revolution. Area farmers, who for generations grew tobacco, are now harvesting organic bell peppers. Once the peppers are boxed, they are shipped to an Atlanta branch of Whole Foods Market. Sam Askins, a 50-year-old organic farmer, used to grow tobacco, but he got tired of getting sick from the chemicals he sprayed on tobacco leaves. Other farmers who planted tobacco for decades have also switched to organic farming due to its increased profitability. The interest in organic farming was aided by the local organic label Appalachian Harvest, which has helped double the number of organic farmers since 1999. Produce now goes to restaurants and markets in Virginia and is shipped as far north as Philadelphia. New farmer Warren LaForce, in his late 20s, is looking at new ideas like a mobile greenhouse, use of mushroom compost, and growing organic seedlings for local growers. As the farmer remarked, "When I'm my dad's age, I want to be the guru of organic vegetables." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
After after weeks of rising popular anger and police violence, which killed some 75 protesters, Bolivian President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada resigned from office and fled to Miami. The latest in a series of confrontations between the country's poor majority indigenous population and the government involved widespread opposition to a deal that would have sold Bolivian natural gas to the U.S. and Mexico via a Chilean port. The outgoing president, a U.S. ally and staunch supporter of free trade and neoliberal economic policies, was replaced by his vice president, Carlos Mesa, a journalist and historian who was quite new to politics. As he was sworn into office, Mesa pledged to hold a national referendum to gain approval for any future arrangement to export Bolivian natural gas and to discuss limiting his own term in office by scheduling a special election. Over the last several years, Bolivia's poor have risen up to overturn the privatization of a major city's water system and derail the International Monetary Fund's plan to impose harsh budget cuts to social services. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, who analyzes the roots of that nation's popular rebellion and the wider significance for the growing global and regional movement resisting U.S.-backed economic policies of free trade, privatization, and concessions to multinational corporations.
To put this in context, this was Bolivia's third war or civic uprising in 3 years over an issue that really is about globalization. In 2000, here in Cochabamba, we had a civic uprising when the Bechtel Corporation was given control of the public water system in Cochabamba and raised people's water rates unbelievably. A civic uprising kicked Bechtel out. In February, there was a civic uprising when the International Monetary Fund sought to impose an austerity package on the country. People did not accept it. There was an uprising in the nation's capital, La Paz. 33 people were killed, but the IMF plans were shelved. So this uprising, which has been going on for almost a month, is about the sale of this very large reserve of natural gas that Bolivia has to California. And people here just said no. They said no, I think, for two reasons. First of all, the plan that this company has, Pacific LNG, to sell the gas to California, would pipe the gas through Chile. That runs into a deep historical memory here about the fact that in 1879, Chile basically stole Bolivia's last seacoast and made Bolivia a landlocked country. And so that really sparked a lot of opposition, the idea that this resource would go to Chile and that Chile would make as much money or more off it as Bolivia would. But the other reason is I think people understand that this gas deal is very important for the economic future of Bolivia, and the level of corruption here is so high and the level of public trust in government so low that the people said, no, if we have to wait 10 years, 20 years, we don't care because we want to get a government in place that we have faith in to cut this deal in a way that benefits the people. And so you had road blockades. You had people coming out on the streets. You had a nationwide rebellion that just took on an energy of its own. The government of Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, and I should say, in tactics that were absolutely and totally backed by the United States government, responded not by having any kind of dialogue with the people, but sent out tanks, soldiers, and bullets. At least 75 people were killed here in the last month, many of them shot at point-blank range by the Army. There is a report that the New York Times reported as well that a soldier was shot by his superior officer because he refused to fire into a crowd. That buildup finally turned into a demand that the president resign. And the United States insisted for days and days and days that the president should stay. And people died in those days and days and days that didn't need to. And finally, it became, I think, as clear to the U.S. Embassy and to the president as it had been to everybody else that there was no way on earth the president could stay. So Friday night, he boarded a commercial flight to Miami, and he's gone, and I don't think he'll ever come back to the country again.
Tell us a little bit about Carlos Mesa, the vice president, former historian, who's now in the hot seat. He's the new president. What kind of challenges does he face in calming down a very angry nation.
He's a very interesting man in a very interesting situation. I've interviewed him at length before when he was still the vice president. He is probably the most well-respected historian in the country and more well-known here as a TV journalist. He was on television for years as one of the major journalists. And one of his most noted books is actually A History of the Presidency in Bolivia. So I think he has a deep historical perspective, and we're in a moment of deep historical transition. To be honest, either Carlos Mesa in this next period is an opportunity for Bolivia to find its way and to bring the various factions together and come up with peaceful solutions to the country's problems, or I think that we're in for something much more bloody and violent and desperate than we just had. He's done a couple of things that are very risky, but I think aren't right. The first thing he did is he stood before the Congress and he said, there will be no political parties in my government. He's now going to try to be president of the country with no official base of political support. So he has to appeal directly to the people. So at a symbolic level, he's doing all the right things. But we'll see. In my interview with him in May, he was much more of an advocate of the government's economic policies and of U.S.'s economic policies than he sounds like now.
The events in Bolivia underscore growing global opposition to corporate-led globalization projects and policies around the world, but particularly in Latin America. What impact do you think the recent events in Bolivia will have on Latin America in particular?
I think the repercussions will be huge. A president of a country was kicked out as a result of a political fight over globalization. People are just beginning to tune in to something that's been going on for a while, which is this pocket of South America is communicating a very powerful message to the world, not just about what it wants, but about what it's willing to go through to get it and its ability to win it.
That was Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center based in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Contact the center by calling area code 415-564-4767 or visit their website at www.democracyctr.org. As the Justice Department and FBI began their investigation into allegations that Bush administration officials leaked the identity of a covert CIA operative to a conservative columnist, questions about the integrity of the probe were coming from senior criminal prosecutors and high-level FBI officials. Calls for Attorney General John Ashcroft to recuse himself from the case due to his close political relationship with potential targets of the investigation and appoint an independent prosecutor have been ignored. Valerie Plame, the CIA agent whose identity was revealed in the scandal, is the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had publicly refuted President Bush's claim that Iraq was seeking uranium in the African nation of Niger for a nuclear weapons program. The White House had sent Wilson to Africa in 2002 to investigate the matter and ignored his findings. President Bush repeated the false charge in his January State of the Union speech, using it as a key justification for war. Wilson has accused the White House of exposing his wife in an effort to punish him and intimidate others who might come forward to criticize the president's misrepresentations about Iraq and the rationale for war. Nonetheless, more military and intelligence officials have publicly challenged the White House on its Iraq war policy. Greg Thielman, a former State Department expert on Iraqi weapons systems and aide to Secretary of State Colin Powell, now says that key evidence presented by Powell at the UN misrepresented the truth and deceived the public. Former retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner, who taught at the National War College, has published a report that documents dozens of deliberate distortions made by U.S. officials to sell the war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA Estimates Officer David McMichael, who takes a critical look at the Justice Department's investigation into White House leaks and the larger issue of wartime propaganda.
According to Bob Novak, who on July 3rd published a column in the Washington Post, which attempted to diminish the importance of Joe Wilson's findings from his mission to Niger, also just offhandedly declared that, well, he'd only been asked to go there because his wife was an undercover agent for the CIA. Now, it took some time before this, you know, really became a major scandal. People picked up on it. And what makes it extraordinary is this: to under the 1983 law, which was pushed very hard by the current President Bush's father, former CIA director and then vice president, to make it a major felony for anyone with official access to classified material to identify a U.S. intelligence officer. It carries a 10-year penalty, in jail penalty, by the way. This is the Intelligence Identification Act, and this is the first major violation of this.
The Justice Department, under Attorney General John Ashcroft, is now conducting this investigation as to who might have leaked this information to the press and to Robert Novak. But there's a lot of criticism, of course, because John Ashcroft is a lifelong Republican activist and has a lot of links with those people being accused of making this leak in the White House itself. So the Democrats and even internal critics at the Justice Department and the FBI want a more independent-minded person to be conducting this investigation. Do you think that we will ever find out who leaked this information, given that currently, as it stands, Attorney General John Ashcroft, with all these links to the White House and the Republican Party, is in charge?
It does make one somewhat suspicious, doesn't it? And unfortunately, this is a very large part of our criminal justice system, whether at the national level, state level, municipal level. Those persons charged with enforcing the law when it comes to cases of corruption, let us say, involving those members of their own party or people to whom they've been close politically, who are running that state or that city or some branch of the United States government, you know, naturally it's difficult. And that's why some years ago the independent counsel law was passed. It no longer exists, but it represents the natural suspicion that goes with this. And since, you know, most attorney generals are pretty political people, there's no getting around that, but Mr. Ashcroft is far more both political and ideological than almost any in my life experience.
Well, just one final question for you, David, and that has to do with the collection of exaggerations, misrepresentations, and out-and-out lies of which former Ambassador Wilson spoke about in his own experience. Mm-hmm. But do you feel that before the next presidential election in November 2004, that the public will know more details about the misrepresentations made about why the United States had to fight the war against Iraq? It seems that slowly officials are coming forward. I just read an account of a former aide to Secretary of State Colin Powell has now come out denigrating his former boss's representations to the United Nations.
Yeah, Craig Thielman is a wonderful guy. You know, he had, in fact, retired from the Foreign Service just prior to that time of that speech, but he had been in their Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and he's a very competent, very, very good analyst and former official. And he has come forward, you know, and used the very strongest language, you know, about this. In Australia, Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Wilkie, who served on their national security agency, roughly the equivalent of the CIA here, and also dealt with these matters, has come public and testified before the Australian Senate. And yes, the information continues to come out. If your question is, will this have a strong political effect on the people of the United States as we come into the next election year, it's difficult to say. I think it will if, in fact, I don't like to call Iraq a quagmire, I think it's more like a sand trap, you know, continues there with the number of United States casualties continuing to rise and the costs. As you know, the administration just came to the Congress to ask for $87 billion as the next installment on this adventure in Iraq. And the economy continues bad. Yes, I think at that time that message about the falsification of intelligence will play a distinct role. Dan Ellsberg just gave an interview to Associated Press. I talked to Dan the other night. He, too, just in his private capacities, the man who released the Pentagon Papers in the vain hope of putting an end to the Vietnam adventure in which he had taken a major role. He is calling for people to come forward and do this. We hope that people will do so, and we hope it does have a political effect, not merely in terms of the 2004 election, but a lasting political and policy effect in this country of ours.
That was former CIA Estimates Officer David McMichael, who, during the U.S.-sponsored wars in Central America in the 1980s, publicly challenged the Reagan and Bush administration's belligerent policies there. Yael Martin is executive director of the National Peace Organization Promoting Enduring Peace and just returned from 3 weeks in Israel, where she met with many different women's groups, both Israeli and Palestinian, who are working toward a peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Martin lived in Israel for 20 years, returning to the U.S. in 1999. She is a member of Brit Tzedek Shalom, or the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace, whose goal is to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory because, in their view, it is detrimental to the interests of both Israelis and Palestinians. Surveys show that only a small percentage of Israeli settlers living in the West Bank and Gaza are there for ideological reasons, while the majority reside there because of the economic incentives offered by the government. One of the ideas promoted by the Jewish Alliance is to pay settlers currently living in the occupied territories to relocate inside Israel's 1967 borders. Yael Martin was a featured speaker at this year's Women's Studies Conference at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven, Connecticut, whose theme was Women, War, and Peace. In her talk, Martin announced Women in Black and eight other less well-known women's groups have come together in the Coalition of Women for Peace to advance nonviolent solutions in the Middle East. The following are excerpts from her talk, recorded October 18th by Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus.
What I have to tell you might give you a little bit of hope in what seems to be an endless saga of despair. First, I'd like to mention the curious fact that the media and the press, both in this country and in the Middle East, hardly ever mention these women's names or what they're doing. Obviously, the efforts of these women toward peace fall outside of the prevailing siege, victim, war mindset of the majority, a mindset which is encouraged actively by the authorities of both peoples. But one could argue very easily that it is precisely because they are women in this traditional society that they are still marginalized and easy to ignore. How many of us knew, for example, that the International Movement of Women in Black was a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001? How many of us heard about Esther Golan, the Holocaust survivor who has been leading reconciliation projects between Jews and Germans and who accompanied Father Shufati, the Israeli Arab priest, as he took 250 Palestinians to Auschwitz recently? And did you know about a Jewish-Palestinian group called Neighbors, formed by the Jewish and Palestinian women in and around the West Bank town of Sakhnin? Probably not. In fact, I just found out about them. It's very well kept secret. The press, even the New York Times of Israel, as it's called, Haaretz, rarely mentions the work of the women like these. When asked why not, the answer has always been, well, it's not a good time to be talking about peace now. There's so much violence going on. Which is a rather odd statement if you think about it. Women in the Middle East and everywhere else understand that this is exactly the time that we should be talking about peace. And if we wait for an end to violence, when will we ever talk about it? These nine groups have agreed on nine principles. One, an end to the occupation. Two, the full involvement of women in negotiating for peace. Three, the establishment of a state of Palestine alongside of a state of Israel based on the 1967 borders. Four, recognition of Jerusalem as the shared capital of two states. Five, Israel must recognize its share of responsibility for the 1948 war and for the just solution of the Palestinian refugees. Six, opposition to the militarism which permeates Israeli society. Seven, equality, inclusion, and justice for the Palestinian citizens of Israel. 8, equal rights for women and all residents of Israel. And lastly, social and economic justice for Israel's citizens and integration into the region. The coalition recently organized 2,000 Israeli and Palestinian women for a march in Jerusalem calling for an end to the occupation. Their various nonviolent acts of protest and resistance include removing roadblocks and blockades, filling in trenches around Arab villages which are dug by the army, lying down in front of bulldozers which are sent to demolish Palestinian homes, and even chaining themselves to olive trees which have been slated for uprooting. The effort is continuing as the security wall stroke fence is being built, but still, over 100,000 olive trees and over 50,000 fruit trees belonging to Palestinian farmers have been torn out of the ground to make way for this wall. I'd like to quote Dr. Sumaya Farhat Nasser, co-founder and former director of the Jerusalem Center for Women. In a recent interview, she said, "The women's peace movement in Palestine and in Israel believes that the time has come to end the bloodshed. The time has come to lay down our weapons and our fears. We refuse to accept more warfare in our lives, our communities, and our nations. We refuse to go along with the fear. We refuse to give in to the violence. We refuse to be enemies. Even as we sit here today, women human rights activists from Central America, Russia, and Sweden are joining their Palestinian and Israeli sisters in mobilizing the International Human Rights March in Palestine and Israel, which will take place between this December 20th through January 11th. Hundreds of women from all over the world have registered to join the three-week walk sponsored by the Coalition of Women for Peace and the General Union of Palestinian Women. Women just seem to have that nurturing spirit, the natural inclination toward life. Gila Sversky calls it the tender core, a combination of humility, compassion, and outreach. This is what can bring about the peace. Brutality and militarism never have."
That was Yael Martin of the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace. For more information, call Promoting Enduring Peace at area code 203-878-4769. For more details on the Women's Walk for Peace, visit the website www.coalitionofwomen4peace.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Bill Cosentino, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.